And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, and welcome to the show. And we're coming at you live, like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And before I get to the show, I want to tell you what's coming up, because we have some exciting shows coming up. Next week, we have an Academy Award-winning person, Doug Trumbull, and he's going to be on talking about his project UFO TOG. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that. I'll have to ask him. After that, the week after, we have A.J. Gervard. We have Linda Moulton Howe coming up, and a really good one in December. We have actually Colonel Charles Hult and John Burroughs together. And if anyone knows the backside of the story of Rendlesham Forest, you're going to know that's going to be a real exciting show, quite some magnitude. And our guest tonight is a longtime UFO researcher, Art Campbell, UFO crash book. And he's done some great research over the years and thinks he has some UFO evidence. We're going to be talking about that later on. For tonight, we have on the phone right now Alejandro Rojas out at the site exactly where Travis Walton was abducted 39 years ago this evening, November 5th, 1975. He's in, I'm not sure, Heber, I think it is, Arizona.
Heber,
how you doing, Alejandro?
Good, and it's surreal. I'm up here on this mountainside near where everything went down, and there are some lights coming through the forest, and I think this might be Travis Walton driving up. He's about 3.5 hours late to the event. We're hopefully going to be able to get a daytime tour of the area, but it's very dark and very cold.
Yes,
So I've got Ben Hansen right here. He's actually, oh my gosh, I think I see Tracy Torme in there. Is that him? Well, anyways, I have Ben Hansen right next to me. He's got his night vision out here, and he's going to be doing a presentation. But a lot of the people are just getting here, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, make sure you say hi to Ben, and what a great idea that was for him to come there with all that equipment. And you're going to another site? You're going to actually do some sky watching?
No, we're actually going to do sky watching right here. The plans have changed a few times. But we're actually going to do the sky watching right here. Ben's got everything set up for it. And, we're good to go.
You know, when you first said that you saw the lights coming through the trees, you know what I was thinking, don't you?
Aliens.
It was coming back. And maybe it was going to drop Travis off.
No, unfortunately, this was just a truck. This was a UFO that had has Travis in it, but it's a man-made. It's unidentified. I've been able to confirm that it is humans on board this craft, and it is a land transporter created by human beings.
Okay, so we can't go into any conspiracy on that. All right, so. How many people would you say are there right now around you at the site?
Well, there's been about, luckily we were all waiting for a while, and luckily there's a forest lady who was able to, she was heading up here, and we were able to get up with her earlier. So we got some great footage because we're going to do some video stuff and post that online. People will be able to see it. We'll have some interviews with some for Travis and the witnesses, but we were able to get here while there was some daylight to get some footage of the area that we'll definitely be sharing on our YouTube later on. So there is us three or four, and then Ben was up here with a couple people. Ben's been up here for like 6 hours or something. He got set up hours ago waiting for things to get started. And we've been waiting, just us, six or seven people for few hours now, waiting for the rest of the group, and they're just getting here.
And have you seen Travis yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, the backside of the story is this week earlier, I sent Travis a satellite phone because I didn't think anyone had any service there. I was told that there was no cell service. So,
well, mine goes on and off.
Yeah.
So, luckily it is working now.
Yeah. Well, don't move an inch. So, what would you guess that, you know, I know you live in, it's like blasting hot, and Arizona has so many extremes. So you're typically in near 100 degree weather, aren't you? And now it's, what would you say the temperature is there?
Yeah, you know, down where I'm at, in the Phoenix area, we've got, you know, 80s during the day, gets down to maybe upper 50s at night, you know. But here it's probably in the 20s up on this hillside. There's a cool wind coming in, and it is very, very cold and getting colder by the minute.
I can't believe you lasted up there all that time. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it is kind of difficult to be. Uh-huh, go ahead.
No, I just wondered, is there actually snow on the ground?
No, there's no snow here. I don't think it's snowed out here yet. But it's starting to be that time of year.
Yeah. Hey, Alejandro, just while we're waiting to see perhaps if Travis pokes his head out of a truck or whatever, any news that you can think of that happened over the week since we last talked? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but is there any story?
You are, but you know what? There's always something cool going on. So, let me put my thinking cap on here. Shoot. Let's see. We've written about some really cool stuff lately. Oh, my gosh. My brain is probably just frozen over because we're writing about news
Talk about earlier. We had someone.
And if you could bring up the site while I'm here, you know, and give me a heads up on a title, I'll tell you all about it.
I can do that. Hey, listen, we were talking a little bit earlier. I should say we were texting back and forth about this Crow 777. It was a and Lee Spiegel wrote about it. Do you know anything about that particular thing with the objects?
I do know quite a bit about it. In fact, just this week I interviewed Lee Spiegel about it. And of course, during the time Lee Spiegel, it's funny because I saw the video, and it was this video that this Crow 77 put up of what he believed to be a UFO cruising near the surface of the moon. I thought it was an interesting video, but, you know, I know, it's always best to get some experts to look at it because they are able to identify things sometimes you're just not able to think of. So I asked Ben Hansen here of Factor Faith and then Mark D'Antonio, and they replied to me and said, funny thing, we just answered Lee Spiegel and sent him some information. So essentially, Lee Spiegel wrote up the story, and both Ben and Mark feel that what that was a satellite he captured moving in front of the moon. This gentleman is a amateur astronomer, and he caught this on a telescope. And one of the questions I had is he drew kind of a straight line, and he showed that this thing does not travel along the straight line. And so I asked, you know, that seems mysterious. That's one of his arguments, that it's not a satellite. And their answer was there's a lot of scintillation, you know, that goes on. The atmosphere.
Oh, yes.
So things move. And so it makes it look like it's going along a straight line, but it actually is. And they were able to show the trajectory, you know, actually doesn't change at all. And it does move slow and steady like a satellite would. So both Ben and Mark, who certainly do not always agree, and I think we've talked about that on your show before, did agree that this object was a satellite. But the gentleman who took the video completely disagrees with that assessment, and he told Lee Spiegel that, and he made a video where he argues their point. And Lee said, okay, you know, I'll post your video too. So Lee did post that response in his story.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I'm kind of disappointed. I didn't blast this everywhere because when I didn't hear from Travis today, I didn't post it everywhere that he was going to be on the show live from the event site. But so I'm a little disappointed.
I could try to walk around a bit, though. There's a lot of people now. They're all finally getting here almost 4 hours later. I could try to mill around. Oh, look, there's Don Schmidt. I can see in this crowd of people. I can try to go look around here and see if I see him. If you want. Hopefully I won't lose signal.
Yeah.
I think
if you pass him.
Let me grab him. Yeah, okay. I do see him. Let me come over here. So I'm going through. I'll tell you what I'm doing. Going through these crowd of people, many of the speakers among them. I see a tall man over here with a hat on that I believe to be Mr. Travis Walton. I'm coming through the forest, the same forest Travis was in. Oh, no, that's Ben. Dang it. But
okay. All right, well.
But I do see.
You're a good storyteller.
I could pull Don
Schmidt
aside. Let me have you say hi to Don Schmidt.
Oh, sure.
Let's see if I could get him. He's saying hi to someone. But,
well, Don Schmidt's been on the show a couple of times. He's one of the Roswell.
He's in conversations with someone. But let me come further into the forest here. And, here's another group of people, all apparently human.
Now, let me just ask you this. Is there any lighting there at all, or are you just seeing, like, dark, dark
figures? Very little.
Yeah.
But it's almost a full moon, so the moon's very, very bright. Here he is. Here he is.
Okay.
Hey. You're
Travis?
Here he is.
Hello.
Hey, Travis. How are you?
All right. I'll get that satellite phone.
No, that's all right. We'll talk on this phone.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I hate to waste the satellite phone. We probably have better reception.
Yeah, well, we only got a couple of minutes because we have the show guest, Art Campbell's waiting on the line here. So we only have a couple minutes. I'm just really glad that it's worked out that I was actually able to speak to you right at the site. Are you excited to be there?
Well, excited is not the word. I'd say apprehensive.
Well, yes, I could have used another word, yes. How does it feel being there? This is 39 years to the day, and
yeah, I've never been here on the anniversary at night ever. Now, one of the guys on the crew has been here two or three times on the anniversary at night, and I tell him, "Oh man, I don't know why."
Yeah. Now, is there anyone there besides you from the crew?
Well, two are coming to the conference, but, you know, I was delayed a bit getting equipment for this event, and so I haven't even greeted everybody that came.
Yep. Well, you made it. That's important. And why don't you tell everyone, the listeners here, about the summit that's going on this weekend?
Hey, thanks. I'm doing a radio interview. Yeah. Say that again, please.
Yes, why don't you go ahead and tell everyone about the summit, the Sci-Fi, what is it?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, this is the 39th anniversary, and, you know, there's no particular significance of that for why I'm doing it now, other than that somebody finally talked me into doing this after dinging at me for over a year. But I thought it would be, you know, the fact that November 5th falls on a Wednesday this time, just like it did back then, was significant. Mm. And it turned out to be the most popular thing about this conference.
Really?
Almost every single person who signed up for their conference wanted to do this, even though it's 2 days before. It's a kind of a pre-conference event, you know. And we're going to go on a tour tomorrow and take people to the site of my return and to the phone booths where I called for help that night. And also we're going to go to the courthouse where the men were given the state police lie detector test. And I'm thinking we'll have at least one other crew member by then.
Now, is the phone booth actually still there?
Yes, the three phone booths are still there, even though phone booths are an anachronism.
I know, they're almost extinct.
You know, because of cell phones, they just, as a matter of fact, they're kind of kept in place as a sort of a monument, because they're not even hooked up and haven't been for years. But the phone company has preserved them, and they wind up getting a lot of graffiti on them from places around the world. But I'd like to discourage the graffiti, but the, people, I drive through there on my way to somewhere else a lot of times, and I'll see people taking pictures there.
Now, let me just ask you this. Has anyone ever placed a plaque or anything near the site there?
No, not near the site. And because there's ongoing research into, some magnetic anomalies and some radiation and some alteration in the tree growth at that site, even the people who have come on this Skywatch here were asked to sign a non-disclosure about the location.
Really?
And that's going to be necessary till we at least, have finished the research into this strange growth of these trees.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
But,
now, I think I heard you say that in the area, in the center part, everything is, all these tree growths are happening toward the center where the object was, and but not around
the
edges, the other sides.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. You know, the skeptics were saying, well, anything could make the tree grow faster. But if you look at the tree in cross-section, and the thicker rings are in the direction of the craft, whether you go northeast, south, or west of ground zero there, that's proof that some central source was causing this. And one of our team, Ben Hansen, the former host of Fact or Fake, came across some research that was done on Scott's pine trees in the Chernobyl area, and it documented the accelerated growth of trees by 3 times in response to radiation. So we are seeing a connection to just, straight radiation, although I wouldn't say that's conclusive that that's what caused it. Some sort of energy, I believe, from that craft generated this accelerated growth.
Right. I mean, that alone, really says something, to, like you said, to all the skeptics. And there's a lot of the skeptics out there that, try to bash this story, and they always seem to fall apart.
They do, because they're not interested in the facts, and they'll start talking before they even have the facts.
Right. Well, hey, I want to wish you great luck with the summit this weekend, and say hi to all friends of the show that you see out there.
Okay, great.
All right, Travis, you take care.
Yeah.
I hope to be talking to you soon.
Yeah, we'll do another one.
All right, sounds good.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So now we're going
Bye.
To be... bringing on our guest. If you just hang on for a little quick music break, we'll be right back with Art Campbell.
Have a little music break.
Hey, Art, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for hanging in while we spoke with Travis.
It's my pleasure.
And it's real fun to have you on, because you are a longtime researcher. Can we talk about your past and when you got started? And I'm always interested to know, I read somewhere where you started in the 1950s.
That's correct, yes.
I want to find out what got you started in the first place.
Well, the UFO thing didn't really hit in those early days. I was talking about here in 58, 59. There were clubs being formed, but nothing really happened. And that's 30 years before Roswell. Well, the Roswell book was published. So we knew that the things were up there, but there were clubs that got formed. So we started a club in Kansas City, Missouri, and I then moved over to to start an ICAP group there. And so we had the first, I believe, the first ICAP chapter in the state of Missouri in those years. And so I had done some work for Donald Kehoe.
Oh, yeah.
And he had me to investigate a claim by George Adamski that he was taken off of a train and taken to Davenport, Iowa, a flying saucer. Well, I called Kehoe and said, "You want me to look into this?" He said, "I sure do." And he said, "Let me send you a badge first." I thought, "Oh, a badge? Are you going to swear me in or whatever? I don't know." So anyhow, I got this badge, it was a big old thing, a black case, and I got practice slipping it out in the living room and everything. And so it got me in to see all the railroad people and the detective of the railroad, and he got a hold of the story. And they didn't want any. It was a Rock Island Railroad. They didn't want any publicity that the UFOs had stopped and pick people off the train, you know. Mm-hmm. So we had lots of cooperation. So anyhow, that was one of the things we did. And I stayed active until about 1960. And then I hung it up for about 30 years, and was in a small town teacher.
Let me just ask you something, if I could,
before we
move on. What made you hang it up for that 30 years?
Well, when you go to small towns, and you're a teacher, a coach, and sometimes a counselor, but once later on, I was a school administrator, there aren't enough people in small towns who get together and talk about things like this. So we're talking here a town of 1,500, maybe 500 people. I mean, a town that was less than that. There just isn't enough people who have done any reading at all. In those days, it was almost all reading. To try to do anything, and the school district didn't frown a little bit on people going way out on a limb, you had to play pretty close your cards pretty close in those days if you were a teacher. You weren't repressed, but they didn't encourage you to speak out on controversial things at all. So that's primarily was just to keep my job is why I kept quiet.
Mm-hmm. And then conversely, what got you back and interested in the subject?
Well, I retired in 1989, and I started reading a little bit, and I got a hold of Stanton Friedman, and he said, I said I wanted to visit a site where there maybe a UFO landed. He said, "Well, there's a one at Roswell," but he said you have to stand in line and get a special trip out there, and I think it's $30 to get out there. Herb Korn was, I think, paid his daughter's way through college on people going to and from that site out there at Roswell. And I said, "Is there anything else?" He said, "Well, there's one out on the plane that's kind of gusted we don't know very much about, but I was out there several years ago." This is Friedman. And it was on our way back to Oregon, where I'm calling from now. And so we decided to go out there and take a look at it. And the rancher, we met him early morning. He was getting ready to work cattle, and he gave us a map, showed us how to get down to the site. Now, he bought the property in 82, but he said there's some strange doings there in the sagebrush, and something took out the sagebrush, and it wasn't any chemical or anything. He didn't know what it was. So we got a map and went out there, and it was very, very interesting. And I was living with my wife in a new car, so we didn't get too far down into the sagebrush. But the next year, I came back with a pickup truck, and I started finding material on the ground, on the surface.
Really? Well, hey, before we move on, there's someone up on. We have a message board on our website, and someone wanted to ask me to ask you what year that was when Adamski was taken off the train and the one that went to Davenport.
December 1st, 1958.
Wow, you got it right down to the day. How about that?
Well, I did the investigation, so I can share that material. If that person would email me, you get the email off the website, and I'll be glad to talk with him and send him a piece. It was written up in the National Investigations Committee newsletter the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so it was 1958. Adamski was getting ready to go to England, and a lot of contactees, I'm not saying they're all like this, but once you talk a lot and you stop getting invitations, then you got to come up with a new wrinkle. And this has happened, the UFO. This happens.
It happens today, too, yeah.
Yeah, it sure does, yes. And so this was his new wrinkle when he went to England. Well, he got over to England, and he was confronted with this at the news conference. He tried to grab the papers and everything. He made a real fool of himself. But Kehoe always thought that we, in those days, we hadn't had a way to separate the sheep and the goats. Real scientific people interested in UFOs and people who were looking at for some kind of kooky paranormal experience. And they were mixed up in those days. And he said that our investigation had pretty well separated the scientific people who were serious and from the for those who were dreaming about things.
Hey, before we move on, I just want to say, anyone listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com, and just two clicks, you can get right in our chat room and ask. Our guest this evening is Art Campbell, a longtime researcher. And now we're going to talk about the, you're talking about objects that you're finding at a site. Can you describe them, and can you also tell us what tests you have done on these types?
Okay, well, could I mention my website? It's on my homepage. I'm going to be talking off my homepage of my website. And could I give that number out right now?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, www.UFOCrashBook.com. www.UFOCrashBook.com. And it's a big, it's quite a nice website. We started finding things. The first thing we found, you can see it on the website, which was a plastic thing. It turned out to be made out of polyethylene, and it's down on the left hand side of the page. And we've had it analyzed in all kinds of places, and it. As near as we could tell, it's a body, an artificial body part. It's made with the same material that you make Tupperware out of, and it has several layers. And but that's a guess. We had all kinds of medical people look at it. Well, then we started finding found a little shoe sole. That's also on the website page down to the bottom. I scroll down, you'll see it. And it's 4 7/8 inches long, but only 1 1/4 inches wide at the instep. We have children who, all of us have feet that at one time were 4 7/8 inches long, but they were also 3 inches wide. This is a very narrow shoe that doesn't fit any earth foot that we've ever been found out, but that we know about, and a little shoe sole. Then in the succeeding years, we begin to find pieces of foil, metal foil, all kinds of, sometimes we find bones and things like that. And we were, maybe a mile south of where people were throwing trash in the arroyo. And the people out there, not part of the country, didn't haul their trash off. They put it in the nearest creek bed, and when they had a flash flood, it was gone. Well, of course, where did it go? Went down where we were working. And that's true. Every arroyo has water in it. People use it to get disposed of their trash. And we had mixed in with tin cans and things like that. We managed to come up with a system of getting pieces of our foil off of the surface. I found about 6 or 7 pieces, and then Mr. Chuck Wade from Gallup, New Mexico, I invited him there in 2005, and he brought a crew of Navajos, and they dug up at least another 5 or 6 pieces of this foil. And another hard piece, which we think is part of the upper exterior of the craft. So we probably have 15 or 20 pounds of material we've been analyzing since 2010.
So now, what would, let's just throw the skeptic in the room here. What do you say to the skeptic that says, why on earth would you say this has anything to do with a craft or a saucer? What do you say to that?
Well, we had it analyzed at laboratories, and let's take the foil, for example. We had it analyzed, and they found out it was coated with some rather, very exotic materials on one side, and it was not part of our metallurgy in those years to mix those elements together in a little coating on one side of the foil. Then we found another place where apparently the craft had skipped down. It was in open rangeland. There's no one that has been there in years. And the cattle are around there when they're put in the area. This is where they graze. And up at the bunch grass, it grows up a little higher. We're basically in an arroyo. We went up a little higher for this other material. And apparently the craft had skipped down there and left a bunch of material. So if those people who are skeptical want to look at my book, you can order it through Amazon, Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And I have directions for getting a hold of the book on my website. That's www.ufochristbook.com. And you just scroll down, it says how to order it. And so I would recommend anybody who is doubtful about anything in the UFOs, we really found that the first civilians to find this much material. And we had it to laboratories and analyzed it. That material is all in the book. As a matter of fact, the guy who did most of our work, named Steve Coburn, he used to work for Dr. Lear, Roger Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a button on the website, says Metal Analysis Coburn. And if they click on that button, it'll go to another page, and with a 42-page report on the first half of the material we found there, it's for free, and you can download it. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful job at color. Now, so we're not holding anything back at all.
When's the last time someone was, to your knowledge, out at the sites or this particular site? And where is that? You don't have to say exactly where it is, but where is that located?
South of Dattle, on off of Highway New Mexico Highway 12, and I don't keep in touch with the rancher, but half a dozen people know about the site, and or a few more, and so we pretty well. I don't know. I was there a year or so ago. We were done with our work there. But things still appear because when it rains, you have the rain washing off things that were buried very shallow. And apparently there was a lot of material laying around, and it was covered over by, we think it was an inexperienced Army crew. They hadn't had a UFO, and this was 4 days before the Roswell material was taken into Roswell, by the way. It's possible that the two craft collided, but we didn't really be sure of that.
How many miles would you say apart would that be?
Oh, 165 miles due west of Roswell,
huh,
in the west central New Mexico.
How about that? Up on the message board, has anyone suggested that the small shoe that you were talking about earlier may have some type of Native American origin?
Well, I don't think Native Americans had cotton that they wove. And this shoe had several layers of cotton, and also some sophisticated material that had to be done in a petrochemical environment. This is pretty much like a little tiny running shoe, and some molded rubber in there, actually natural rubber, and the sole was a natural rubber. You see a picture of it on their website at the bottom left side, and. We had it looked at by some 30 different shoe companies, and none of them could identify it.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. And why? Just why would you? Let's just throw this out there. What kind of relationship would, say, if it is extraterrestrial, have to do with cotton? You know, I mean, is this something you've actually thought through?
Well, we're assuming that if it doesn't fit into known Earth foot, that it was made somewhere else. And essentially, that's what we have. And we've been on this now since 1994. We're not talking about finding something last week or last year.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost the 19th year we've been working on this project.
Wow. You know, you hear that they've had a lot of digs out in Roswell, speaking of that, you know. And as far as I have heard, someone at one time thought they found something. But have you ever looked into any of the digs out there? I know you said you weren't going out there, but have you ever looked into that?
Into what out there?
Into what people have found in the Roswell crash area.
Oh, no, I have never been to a Roswell site. I do know Frank Kimbler that worked the Roswell site with a metal detector and found some very interesting material. I think he was on Alejandro's show some time back about it. But we found pieces of foil. And, well, it's somebody's gum wrapper. Well, that may be, but there's different thicknesses of it. And it's all coated on one side with a whole lot of chemicals. And we don't have the metallurgy to even make this kind of stuff, let alone. So occasionally when it rains, it's right below the surface, and the rain will wash it off. I found a lot of our stuff already on the surface, early stuff.
Now, are you actually following any modern-day cases at this point?
Any modern-day what?
Any modern-day cases or crashes, supposed crashes?
I have only worked one. I've had my hands full with this one.
Really, just one?
And, I live 1,300 miles from the site, and I made about a dozen trips there in 9 to 10 years. And I had my hands full getting the material to a lab and finding we found a donor who sent our material to the laboratory in 2010, and that really is what gave us an idea of what we had. We saved everything we could possibly find, and we waited for somebody to come along and help us out with a donation. We run a test called ICP-MS, which your listeners can look it up. It's a test essentially where they pulverize everything and put it in a medium like some kind of a juicy type thing, and spray it into a chamber at 26,000 degrees. And out the other end comes a graph of what kind of material it's made of and all the ingredients that are in that material. And we've had up to 60 different types of material shown up with those graphs. And we think maybe we don't pay too much attention to anything under 100 parts per billion. We think anything over 100 parts per billion is probably put in the metal. The others may be just trace elements. But it will read just of everything, and it's a wonderful device. But every time we ran something through it, it costs us $500. Mm. So we've had some people help us out. John Rowe helped us out with Open Minds. He did the first thing. Then I had an anonymous donor that helped us out with the big material we found in the last few years.
Now, when it comes to you having these tests done, you say they cost $500. So I'm sure you're really careful. You go through what can be organic or explain first. You kind of just weed it out. What's that process like?
Well, let me give you a little bit about my background. My background is in Western history and pioneer history, and so I'm pretty well attuned to what you would find pioneers would leave. And this material we found is nothing you'd find that any early settler. We probably went maybe 1875, Civil War to present time. This is very modern historical research. So I've written several of the books on history, and published in my in Oregon. And one of them was published by an article was published by the Oregon Historical Society, and I've written several of the books on ranchers and specific areas. I did a little book on the little town of Antelope, and we had an Indian sect came in 1984. It was a leader called the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. He brought about 700 or 800 people with him. They were buying a ranch south of the little town, and that didn't set up too well with local cowboy types, having people wearing red suits and with big mouths. So they folded up after about 2 years when they kind of imploded. But we spent quite a bit of time in the western area, so we get a pretty good idea of what they throw away. Now, what's the rare time you'll find license plates? They said you really know what you've got. But we've only found one or two.
Up on the message board, there's a gentleman that's asked a number of times, do you know anything about, I think it was Eisenhower, they said met the E.T. at an Air Force base? Or anything like that? Have you ever looked into
yeah,
that?
Yeah, everything I know is on my website. Now, he probably looked at my website. On the far button, says Eisenhower and Holloman. And I got a letter from an airman that was there for about a six-month period in 1955. And he said Eisenhower was on his base, and he had reason to believe that he had gone aboard a UFO. Well, that really interested me. Well, I found out Eisenhower was supposed to be hunting in Thomasville, Georgia at the time. And it turned out he came down with a cold the day before, and he was supposed to be playing Scrabble with Mamie by the fireplace. And I have a feeling he went to Holloman Air Force Base and made a contact with extraterrestrials. But anyhow, the whole story was in on the Fires Files about 2007. And I've included that on my website. Anybody who wants to read about what the research we've been doing, it's quite thorough. And we really have tracked him and talked to people who actually saw him at the base. Those who have read Kim Good's very good book, The Earth and Alien Agenda, mm-hmm. He features that story in the chapter 4 of his book. So if any of your listeners have that book, they can read the story and Tim Good's book also. But it has nothing to do with us. This just happens to be something we researched right after 2005 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go way back here. I want to go back to you were around, you know, prior to Roswell, obviously. And what was that like when people started seeing UFOs? And how old were you, you know, let's just say, during 1952 when there were so many sightings everyone was seeing?
I graduated high school in 50. Ah. I'm 30. I'm 82 years old.
Uh-huh.
And there were things in the paper. And, I remember one of some airline people said, well, this thing came over, and they showed us with their hands and how what a size it was and everything. It was a curious anomaly, let's put it that way, for anybody who didn't know it. But there wasn't anybody doing anything about it. Of course, some of the government people may have known about it. But civilians really didn't get involved till the Roswell book came out, the Burleson Moore and Roswell incident. In 1980, and then I think about 10 years later, Stanton Friedman came out with his Kreischer Corona, and in both those books talk about the site we were working. It was discovered by Barney Barnett, who was a civil engineer, worked for the Soil Conservation Service. So, there wasn't a lot to meet about. And this is why Kehoe was so glad to find out that they were get rid of some of the people who were driving him crazy, who didn't have much scientific background, and there was an awful lot of fantasy then, and there is still some today. But it's spread out quite a bit now.
Yeah.
It used to be concentrated.
Mm-hmm. Now, I always think of this like when someone is actually looking for a purported crash site. How on earth do you nail it down to exactly where it's supposed to happen?
The rancher told me that the sagebrush was missing in a certain area, and he said we didn't take it out. And we were able to see it from a hillside, and that was our first time we learned about it. He didn't own it by the property until the 1980s. And it had been visited in the 1990 by Stanton Friedman and a couple of people connected with his books and research. But one of the things that the big wigs at the sites don't do, you never see them with a shovel.
Hmm.
They're always there with some clipboard waving their arms or something. But this is where the rancher told us to we found material, and we started digging and we started finding material.
Right.
And then we found a site where it had skipped down, apparently, and before it came down into the Royal. And it left some wreckage up there, too.
Hmm. And
so it isn't an easy task. We got assistance getting to the site. Then we had to develop our own strategies.
I see. And how many people were involved in actually doing the excavating?
We counted about 26 and five different trips there. And they weren't all the same people. Four or five of them were the same, but different people would come in 2011, then another group would come in about 2012. Mr. Wade was going to conferences and telling people that he'd found this material, and he would invite various people out to the site. Now, these are some times I wasn't there, but he had them kind of swear to secrecy. They wouldn't tell anybody where the site was. And that's kind of where we are right now. We found all the material we think we're going to find, and we put it in this book called Finding the UFO Crash at San Augustine. And we're told it's the only one of its kind in ufology, where the civilians have actually found material and had it analyzed. And everything that we have in the book is analyzed. And mostly a hot piece of metal. We even found part of the propulsion system that was between two pieces of the hull. And it's actually on a web page also, down to see a guy holding with his thumb, holding it looks like a wasp nest. And about the second page, a wasp nest. And that was hollow. Those channels were hollow, and at each end of the channel was a plate, and on the plate was some brown dots that interacted when the plates were heated, where electricity went to the plates, or some kind of a thing. So we think possibly that the layer, or the outside layer, which is extremely tough, and the inside layer, which was not tough at all, were in between the two layers in about an inch and a half of space, and in there was this metal honeycomb that we think went all the way across the top of the craft, maybe 25 feet across from the center line to the at least the bottom half of the craft. And no doubt it had something to do with anti-gravity. But we're just managed to find some pieces and put them together. So it's still the research is still in its infancy right now, but we've got the pieces.
How about that? Now, someone wanted to know up in the chat room if you've ever had any soil analysis done.
Yes. First thing I did was have a soil analysis done, and we went down in the gap area where there was the snow sagebrush. We made seven holes about 15 feet apart in a row, and then on the left side we did about seven holes about 15 feet apart, about 10 feet away, and 10 feet in the other direction we made another seven holes, and so. They asked us to dig down about 8 or 9 inches and not get surface material, but get material that's natural there. And so we had it in one of the early books. We had the material that was we had the soil report.
I see. Now you've limited your research to that one spot, basically. Has anyone in the field agreed with these findings?
Well, we're back to primarily by Stan Friedman. And he has been really great. And he helps us find people, gives us ideas where we get things tested. He knows quite a few labs and so forth. And he's the only main UFO person that we have been working with. There may be others who would like to work with us, but they haven't come forward yet, and it's quite a remote area, so it's a little difficult to get to.
I see. Now, up on the message board, I think it's a pretty good question, is can you describe what the whole crash entailed by witnesses, all the events that led up to it and after?
Well, I have it in the book. It's 16 chapters full of stuff. But I will give you a nutshell of it. The Soil Conservation Service man is driving down a highway south towards the reserve of New Mexico. And he sees something glinting in the distance. And he knows there aren't any sheds or roofs over there because he's talking to all the farmers. And he knows them pretty well, what they're growing. And most of them are running cattle. So you don't see aluminum structures too often where cattle are being grazing. And so he thought it was probably an airplane. In those days, we had lots of aluminum-covered airplanes that weren't painted. And he thought it might be an airplane. So he drove over to the back road in. He knew how to get there. And he got closer to it. He was coming on blindsiding it. It wasn't sitting in the middle of nowhere. It was actually down a little gully. So he more or less stuck up on it. He was very interested in the atomic bomb. And he thought it might have been something nuclear. He wasn't sure. But when he got there, it was a craft that looked like dirty stainless steel. He said 25 or 30 feet across. The man was a surveyor. He really was knew what he was talking about. A very honest man, a Rotarian, Don Socorro, and the people that wrote it are generally in there because they cherish fiction. And then there was some other civilians that apparently had went out to do some rock hunting, and a group of archaeologists came up, and they came from an opposite direction of the highway. And then they're all standing around looking at these creatures, and then the Army drives up and says, well, we're in charge here, and we want you not to say anything. And it's a pretty typical story. You've heard a lot of the Army coming in and saying, we're taking over, and so forth. And the Army had just finished, you know, winning a war for us. So they were pretty high on people's to-do list. You know, they did what the Army says. So most of them left. And how it came out was a friend that Barney told a friend named Vern Mullins from Minnesota. And Stan Friedman was giving a talk at Bemidji, Minnesota. And after the talk, this guy came up to him and said, well, do you know about the crash of the plane in St. Augustine? And Stanton told me, he said, I told him I was all ears. So he got some names and had somebody go check out everything. And that's, by the way, in Stanton's book called Crash of Corona. And it's also the story is also in the Roswell incident, the Berlitz and Moore.
I see. Okay. Getting back to the testing that you had done, did you use just one lab, and was that a certified lab?
We used a lab named Bodie Coat. They took almost a square block of down in the Los Angeles area, and they were one of our initial labs. And we did not tell them what we were sending them. As a matter of fact, the guy that was sent them in, was Steve Colbert, was in another lab. And it was quite common for one lab to farm things out to another lab. They'd have time to work on it. So we didn't have to say what we thought we might have. And we got back the first six pieces. And that's, by the way, written up in the book, chapter four. All those first six pieces that went to the lab, and these were very high, very large labs, and they do work for the government and everyone else. And I assume they have a certification of some type. I don't know exactly what it is, but I didn't even know they were doing this work. Mr. Wayne had found John Rao and been waving a wreckage around at UFO conferences, so I think John said, let's find out what it is. So they got six pieces from Mr. Wade and had it sent in. And it came back, that report that I referred to earlier that you find on the website called Metal Analysis Colbert is the report that shows how they did it and how elaborate it was, and a lot of it's in color, and lots of big color photographs and so forth. And they did an exquisite job on that on the analysis.
Wow, that's great. And let's see, we're just a couple minutes out here. So you mentioned earlier you wrote books on history, and you really focused on this one particular thing when you came back from your 30 years of being away. And how did you get attracted to this one particular incident?
Well, I had talked to Senator Friedman, and he said, I said, I'd like to visit a site before the UFO went down. He said, well, we have the Roswell one here. There's tours you can take out there. Well, my wife and I were in Roswell at that time, and we were passing through on the way back from the East Coast. And we didn't want to stay in Roswell another night. There's nothing wrong with Roswell. It's a nice little place. But we wanted to get on, moving on, you know, towards home. So this was on our way. And so we decided to go out and talk to the rancher here. And he was working cattle that day. By the way, April 20th, the day that they changed the daylight saving time in the spring. And so that's how we found the site. Freeman had been out there, and then we got a hold of the rancher, who he gave us his name, and that's how we got to the site. There was so much going on there, there's no reason to go anywhere else.
I see. And how long ago did your book come out, by the way?
The new book was published in December of 2013.
I see. When you say new book,
I had another one that didn't have the heavy material in it that was published around 2005, but it was just printed, but we didn't have a publisher at the time. This one is on Amazon, and it's doing quite well. And it's about 180 pages, 90 pictures, several scientific reports, and we're getting some very good good reports on the book from readers.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. And again, you can go ahead and throw your website out one more time. It's we want to say it's UFO Crash Book.
Yes, it's www.ufocrashbook.com.
Excellent.
One word, UFO Crash Book is one word.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Well, that's
okay. Well, thank you.
You bet. That's it for the show today. If you miss any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which, of course, is podcastufo.com. You can also check out links and the stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. Well, we want to give a quick thank you out there to Travis Walton and Alejandro Rojas for helping us out. And we also want to say thank you to Keith Rowland, who is the producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. And we want to thank Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music. Peggy Shunning for managing our very active Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out right here next week. Again, we're going to have Doug Trumbull on. It's going to be an exciting show next week. And we hope to see you back here. Thank you. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. And see you next week.